From the KGOU studios, I'm Suzette Gorlot, the Dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies, and welcome to Worldviews. Zia Haider Rahman has worked as a banker, a human rights lawyer, and an anti-corruption activist. He's also an author. Rahman's debut novel, In the Light of What We Know, deals with complex themes of geopolitics, the financial crisis, math, and friendship.
This novel is about knowledge and the question of the extent to which what we think we know is reliable.
I'll talk with Rahman about his novel and about his new project at Harvard that will map the world's elites.
Those are individuals, but also corporations and institutions. They're the influencers and decision makers, and really get a picture of their interrelationship.
That's coming up after news from NPR. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gorlot. Our guest today is Zia Haider Rahman. He's a British novelist who visited the University of Oklahoma as part of the Neustadt Festival of International Literature and Culture. His debut novel, In the Light of What We Know, was awarded the James Tait Black Prize, the oldest literary prize in Britain. Zia Haider Rahman, welcome to Worldviews.
Hi, Suzette. I'm really glad to be here.
It's good to have you here as part of the Neustadt celebration. And I've been really looking forward to this conversation because, you've done so many different things. And of course, we're going to talk about your literature, but many things that you've done. You've been a banker and an international human rights lawyer and an anti-corruption activist, and you've got new tech projects going on now. But let's start with your literature, the novel that was published in 2014, In the Light of What We Know. You cover a lot of territory in this book: friendship, geopolitics, math, science. This seems to be a very broad subject. In the Light of What We Know, what are you telling us in this book? What is this book about?
It's about all those things, but it's also, the question I'm detecting at the heart of what you're saying is, how can these things hang together? Well, first of all, there's space for it to hang together. The book is, I think, something like 500 pages long. Secondly, they hang together because they hang together in the characters. I'm always keen to focus on the preoccupations of the characters. A large part of my thinking in writing is trying to understand what animates the internal lives of my characters. And this novel is preoccupied with, if the preoccupations can be distilled into a short sentence, then that sentence would be that this novel is about knowledge and the question of the extent to which what we think we know is reliable. So it's an epistemological novel. It's an exploration of this fundamental question, which, we see today in all this stuff about fake news and.
That's where I was going to go next.
Yeah.
Tell us how it connects to that sort of.
Well,
issue.
It connects that is one of the central questions of fake news, right? I mean, we're asking ourselves all the time, how can I rely on what I am being told? And what are the indicia? What are the things that cause me to rely on things when I do rely on them? Well, that's a question we should be asking ourselves. But the broader question is that people have seem no longer to be placing faith in the kinds of cultural markers that used to signify authority. Not all people, but some people. And so it is not enough simply that someone on TV, typically a middle-aged white male, is pontificating on TV, and therefore we believe him. For others, they mourn the loss of this trope, the middle-aged white male on TV, whom they vested with so much authority. So these are the sorts of pressing issues. But my novel is an inquiry into that, and you're right. It touches on all these other things. Goes into Afghanistan. Goes into banking, finance. The whole novel starts off in September 2008 when a friend an old friend reappears at the door of our narrator, and they've known each other for since college, you know, and they're now in their early 40s. These two men have two different stories to tell, and the friend who's reappeared starts by telling, by beginning his story and telling it to the narrator.
So, Zia, it's inevitable here that I have to say we're going to talk about you, because I started by noting that you've done a lot of different things in your life. You're telling me about your novel, which, you know, people say you should write what you know, that you obviously you're writing about a lot of different things in your novel. But you said that you want to understand what motivates the internal lives of your characters. So now let's understand what motivates the internal life of you. You've done all of these different things, like I said. You've been a banker and a human rights lawyer and an anti-corruption activist. And you were born in Bangladesh, but you grew up in London. You hold British citizenship. And we're going to get in a minute to something you've written in the New York Times about being Bangladeshi. But what is it that's internally motivating you?
More and more of modern neuroscientific and cognitive scientific wisdom suggests that we're really quite ignorant of our own motivations, and in fact our own motivations are hidden from us. I think one of the things I like about looking at the motivations of my characters is that I can see what they are. It's much harder for me to see what my motivations are. My own motivations are often, you know, things get in the way, vanity or ulterior motives, or the discomfort of confronting a particular kind of motive. So all those sorts of things come into play, and we're not very good at being honest with ourselves. However, I can be very honest about my own character. So that's one reason.
It's a reflection at all. I mean, are you trying to get at your motivation at all, or trying to discover your own self through the characters that you're writing about?
I'm sure there's a little bit of that, definitely. There's a little bit of trying to understand, not a little bit, there's quite a bit of me trying to understand how certain ideas operate in me. It might sound like I'm being a bit evasive, and I suppose I am. But the evasion is not so much because I want to withhold something. It's because the thing I would say in answer to your question is not something I'm sure about. And the thing I would say is I think a lot of my life has been about trying to find home. But I don't know that, right? I catch glimpses of how this desire sort of seems, every so often I sense, that's what I'm doing here. But I can't be sure about that. It certainly explains things, right? And explicative power is not a bad place to start in trying to assess whether a theory is a good one. If it explains a lot of stuff, then it doesn't mean it's true, though, right?
No, because it doesn't explain everything.
It doesn't explain everything.
Not necessarily. Otherwise, it wouldn't be a theory, right?
Yeah.
So you've written about being an immigrant. This beautiful piece I'd recommend to anyone in the New York Times. So now I'm Bangladeshi, where you were referred to as being, you know, you were born in Bangladesh, but you were raised in Britain. You don't hold a passport even. You're British.
I was referred to as Bangladeshi by people who really do know better. So the literary establishment people, and because I was sitting on a jury, a literary prize jury, and they really ought to have known better. They could have. I mean, they did know better. I mean, this is the point. The assumptions, the underlying assumptions of what constituted Britishness, were just they were blind to their own assumptions. You know, they just assumed that it was okay to call me that.
They assumed that it was okay to call you that, And you noted in your piece about these hyphenated identities that it's beyond that even, because it emphasizes otherness, that you can't just be British. You have to be Bangladeshi British. You have to be, you know, because it's noting some distinction that even though who cares where you were born, it's where you were raised and spent your time and what formed your entire life. But one of the things that you said in that piece is every battle of ideas is fought on the terrain of language. And you were referring kind of to this hyphenated thing and the way in which we describe things in our language and our writing, and that we're actually battling out these ideas about identity and immigration and life and who we are and where we come from and who gets to come from where and who gets to claim what as their background, as their identity, that we're battling those things out with these kinds of language. Is that really what you're getting at?
A good example is, absolutely. So, but let me just make this other point. I think we are all looking for home in some sense, right? And that's, and some people, and it's not the fact that I'm an immigrant that causes me, I think, that's not exclusively the point. In fact, I know many immigrants who don't struggle with this, you know, anywhere near as much as I do. But I think we all do in some sense, and that's what the Garden of Eden is all about. That's what it speaks to, this sense of exile that all humanity shares, and that we're all trying to go back to Eden in some form or other. Well, and I don't mean that religiously. I mean that as a literary person might do.
In terms of exploring our humanity.
Exactly.
I mean, that's exactly what you're
saying. And because this shortfall that we all sense in some way, I think a metaphor for that shortfall is not being at home. We feel it, this shortfall. We feel it as if it were not being at home, you know, as if we're not in the right place somehow. We haven't fitted in. But to go back to your question, which I'm trying to remember, and I'm going to remember because I'm Black Lives Matter is an example of that. So when some people counter, well, of course, white lives matter too. You know, it's hard for us to imagine that they don't have the subtlety of language to understand that that doesn't work as a counterpoint, because the phrase Black Lives Matter doesn't mean what they are taking it to mean. So. And I, for one, am not prepared to condemn those who respond to, you know, who make that response. I'm not prepared to condemn them as just being stupid. I don't think they are stupid. I think the very reason why they counter with White Lives Matter, the reason is that they understand what it means. Right? So I think we contest these very subtle ideas in actually quite sophisticated ways, even if on the surface they seem very simple confrontations.
Well, at the very end of your New York Times piece, you said, how much more can I integrate? Yeah. What more do you want from me? Yeah. Do you want me to be like you?
Yeah.
But I want to pick up on this word integrate, because you've just made this argument that it's about the words we use and how we battle out ideas through words. And I've been interested lately in how people use the word integrate as opposed to assimilate. Yeah. This difference between integration and assimilation, and that, I mean, you could look it up and you get the definition, but there's a real there's a kind of underlying meaning there that's really important.
Yeah.
And yet you chose the word integrate.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I did,
and I assume on purpose.
Yes. Well, first of all, it's quite a contested idea whether one ought to those who are perceived as newcomers, should they integrate or should they assimilate, or should they be required not to do either? There's an episteme, and what does it mean? I mean, it's never required by the newcomer, right? It's first of all a requirement of the host, and really what it amounts to is, I want you not to be alien to me by my terms. And then it gets even more problematic, because actually there's no such thing as a host. There are lots of people, lots of different people, just as there's no such thing as a reader for a novel. I mean, from the perspective of the author, there are just lots of readers, right? And that presents problems for writing literature as well. Actually, it's another. But different people have different expectations. But I chose integrate because it's weaker in some sense, right? It's weaker. We understand it as weaker, and I'm saying that, you know, do you want me to do all of that? It also makes the I say to be you, to be white, to be you. I think, I don't know if I actually said to be white in that.
You did.
I did,
yeah.
Yes. By that, yeah. A lot of people have asked me since then. I mean, that particular piece in the New York Times got huge circulation, and people didn't ask me. Friends asked me. I never realized you were that angry. And actually, to the to tell the truth, I'm not that angry.
But it's interesting that that's what people would pick up on, is that you're somehow angry.
Well, I did make it angry. I made it sound angry by the end. You sort of see the emotional charge. Rather than angry, what's interesting is some people saw it as anger. Others saw it as a cry, some people described it as a very moving piece, right?
It is all those things, I think. But it's also very, to me, it's just very, like, straightforward. What more can I do?
There's a list of things that I've done to try and meet you.
Yeah, so tell me, what more can I do? But then it's also that, why do I have to keep asking you what more can I do for you?
Yeah. And the point is that was always a fictional test, that those who decide, who have until now and possibly continue to arbitrate, and they do, they continue to arbitrate on the question of who is inside and who is not, who in this case is British and who isn't, or who is American and who is not. Those who decide that or claim to or believe themselves to be in the position of deciding that, they have no interest in actually giving you anything other than a moving goalpost. So by the time you get there, it will have shifted. Because really what they're about, what deciding is, the very act of deciding is about, is keeping you out.
So let's end on this note.
Yeah.
You were telling me about a very interesting project that you are working on now. You need more stuff to do, it seems to me. You're working on a tech company now, tech enterprise, where you're mapping the world's elite and their relationships.
Yes.
How do you do that?
I'm spending a year at Harvard as a fellow at the Radcliffe Institute. And what I've done, in fact, before I even arrived, we've been pulling together a team of people around the world to map the world's influencers and decision makers. And those are individuals, but also corporations and institutions. They're the influencers and decision makers, and really get a picture of their interrelationships. And I think it's something that really began to bother me about a year ago, when it struck me that newspapers and that the journalists weren't making any headway, that they seemed to be not saying very much, getting very far on questions to do with, you know, the relationships between candidates for the U.S. presidency, relationships between them and Wall Street and foreign governments and foreign corporations. And it just seemed to me very puzzling. Why weren't they making any headway on this? And so this idea, this kind of mapping of interrelationships, using publicly available information, I might add. I mean, that's crucial to this. So we're not doing anything that runs up against libel or defamation or any of that. But there's an enormous amount of information out there that is useful and would prevent a lot of journalists, law enforcement, investigators from duplicating efforts. At the moment, you might have noticed that the Washington Post and the New York Times have recently been showing us lots of diagrams of relationships. Well, the research they've each been doing has actually been the duplication of the other's effort. And at a time when journalism is really being squeezed by the internet, I think it's really important to find as many ways as possible to reduce the costs facing those who, you know, facing the Fifth Estate, that most sacred institution of democracy.
How's that going to work? How is the thing going to work?
I can't divulge everything. I mean, not it's not a, it's tech heavy. So that's one thing. It's tech heavy.
So not usable by everyone.
Oh, no. It should be usable by everyone. The idea is
a database of some sort that we can
absolutely
access. Okay.
And that uses modern network science, science that has really sort of come into its own in the last, I'd say, 15, 20 years. It's been around for a while now, but really come into its own and got a shot in the arm with things like Facebook and LinkedIn and also Twitter and various things like that, that those actually provide large data sources that network scientists are able to use to do research in this field of mathematics. And they've been able, therefore, to develop tools for analyzing network data, which is a different kind of data from the kind of data that ordinarily you think about when you think about big data, such as health data. The network data is a different kind of data and requires different tools. You can't just do your linear regression and things like that, all that secret stuff that goes on. None of that applies. So that makes it very exciting in many different ways. This is a project that has real-world impact, could make a difference, positive difference, will make a positive difference. But it's also satisfying for me because it touches, again, you know, all these different buttons, these things that I'm interested in. I used to be a human rights lawyer. I used to be an anti-corruption activist. I used to be a banker, corporate lawyer. And my first two degrees were in mathematics. So this is touching a lot of different buttons. So
first full circle, it sounds like. Well, I mean, it certainly sounds like a real-world impact, but all of the work that you've done really does seem to be not only very exciting, innovative. It's very innovative and has an impact. And so I appreciate you being here today to share it all with us and our listeners. Thank you.
Suzette, it's been great. Thanks.
You've been listening to my conversation with British author Zia Haider-Rahman. We'd love to hear your thoughts about the discussion or answer any questions you might have. Leave your comments in the Worldview section of KGOU.org. Or like us, follow us, and interact with us on Twitter. We're at Worldviews KGOU, and I'm at Suzette Gorlat. Worldviews is produced in partnership between KGOU and the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Katie Holland prepares our research, Jacob McClellan edited this interview, and Sam Dupre produced the show. I'm Suzette Gorlat.